You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
4 minutes after 10, welcome to the second hour of the show. You're in conversation with Sasonkem Samang and me, Eusebius McKaiser, for the next hour as we talk about her stunning first book, Always Another Country, a memoir of exile and home. And I really do mean it. I know that she hates the excessive melodramatic praise, but it's all true that I lavish upon her. And you can see my English is also going to improve because it does in her company, because she's so beautifully well-spoken. She's one of those few writers who writes as brilliantly as she speaks. She really does. If you don't believe me, go on YouTube. You'll see some of her clips there. And fortunately, we don't have to choose which medium we want her in. We now have her in book form as well. And she is also one of the most hardworking authors. And I have seen many manuscripts, first version and final version. Very few undergo as much change creatively as Sasonkem's work in general does, because she takes feedback seriously. She's very competitive with herself. And just a consummate professional writer. Sasonkem, it's lovely seeing you. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eusebius. I hope I can live up to all of the next hour. Wow.
you totally will. Congratulations. How does it feel?
It feels so good. I literally have been saying, like, if there was an award for excitement, I would be winning it. I am extremely excited to have finally written a book.
You know, you project how you might react, how readers might react, but you don't know until it actually happens. The last week, and especially coming into the country for the launch, how has it been? Cape Town and Joburg?
Kind of overwhelming, you know? Just so much generosity in how people have read the book. All the parts of it that I was a bit nervous about, I'm no longer nervous about. I feel as though in every single instance of people I've spoken to, they have read the book in the spirit in which it was written. And I don't think an author can ask for more than that.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that people have the same take. It doesn't mean that they like every part of it. But I think they've read it with an enormous generosity, and that's been amazing to me.
This book is about so many different things. I was saying to Reedy last night, it's not one of those books where you can say, here's a singular theme. There goes Eusebius writing 250 pages about race again, or about the DA. It is multi-layered. It is also thematically very layered. And even though there is the helpful attempt by the publishers, with Sasonkem's permission, to have the subtitle, A Memoir of Exile and Home, kind of like having music telling you what emotion to feel when you're at the movies. The truth of the matter is that if we took that out, and I know Sasonkem will agree with me, and we just said Always Another Country, sans subtitle, and ask 10 different people to read it and to write different pieces, they will come up with different themes that they think are central to it. But I want to read from page 3. Sasonkem writes the following. So here we are. Nelson Mandela is dead, and so are Walter Sisulu and Govan Mbeki. Lillian Ngoy and Ruth First and Fatima Meer and Neville Alexander and Dennis Brutus and the whole raft of great women and men who stood for and embodied a more just humanity are all gone. In their place is a new country, one that is ordinary and disappointing, even as it has its moments of startling and shiny brilliance. The South Africa I had imagined as a child was a place of triumph, a crucible out of which a more dignified and just humanity would emerge. My parents were freedom fighters, so they cast our journeys around the world as part of a necessary sacrifice. Our suffering was noble. South Africa would one day be great because the indignities meted out to us were teaching us to abhor injustice, to inoculate us against inequality. And yet here we stand in a South Africa that is free, but not just. For me, this is perhaps the most difficult fact of all to accept. It is hard to say, but I'm coming to understand that perhaps it is true that heroism is impossible to sustain during ordinary times. When the guns died down and the smoke cleared, we discovered we were not exceptional. All along, we had been only human. I mean, for me, that is one of the most touching political themes of the book, captured in those two paragraphs, Sasonkem. But what is wonderful about the book, and I want you to reflect for me on this, is that you have a very analytic brain. You're also at the same time very lyrical as a writer. So you were very careful, and you got it right in this book, to write beautifully, aesthetically sentences that just you want to drape around you. But at the same time, this was not meant to be some melancholic description of dystopia.
Absolutely. Because I think dystopia doesn't, having an analysis that everything is terrible and that things have fallen apart and will never be redeemed doesn't take us anywhere. It doesn't help us through the present. And it doesn't, give us a sense of future. So I wanted the book to be accessible, and I wanted the book to also challenge me as a writer. So the idea of writing as a craft has become more and more important to me in the last few years. And so that was a big test for myself, but I wanted to be conscious that I have an audience, that people would be reading it. And I wanted them not to enjoy the prose, but to think, because ultimately, I think, you know, politics matters very much to me.
Absolutely. Now, we travel with you and with your family around the continent. We go to Canada, we go to the States, and of course, we also eventually go to Australia with Simon. But what's quite fascinating to me is how evocatively you remember the different places. Do you have a copy of your book there?
I do.
Or can you want to borrow one of mine? I've got two. I've made it in life.
No, I've got a copy, and it says Sisonke's copy, because people are shameless and will ask you for a free book.
Now, I want you to read, because she does have a stunning reading voice as well. And I want you to read the opening paragraph about Burley Court.
So,
from when I was little.
What page are you on?
I'm on page seven.
Seven. Yes. Okay. When I was little, we stayed in a series of flats. First, it was Burley Court, then some apartments near the University Teaching Hospital, then a small complex in a neighborhood called Woodlands. The one imprinted on my mind is Burley Court, perhaps because it was the biggest, perhaps it was because it was the one Mommy spoke of the most. Burley Court was just off Church Road, which was a busy street close to the center of Lusaka. The residents of Burley Court were part of a new generation of urban Africans who were not concerned with what whites thought of them. Each block smelled like kapenta fish and frying meat. As you walked past open doors and windows, you could hear the tinny sounds of Thomas Mafumo's mmm, or the elegant chords of Letambulu's "There's Music in the Air." Do you want me to stop?
The singing or the reading? I want you to close your eyes and just listen to a little bit of this. And I was thinking about your description of Zambia last week on the open line. We had this big debate following, well, on her version, a misdescription of what she had said about exile on the part of Lindiwe Sisulu. And there were some people who saying, yeah, these people in exile have such romantic lives, and they think that they were better blacks than the ones who were inzales. The Zambia that you describe is so many different things. There is the idea of South Africa that becomes lodged in the heads of the men and women who jump the border. And that is something that motivates them in the struggle against colonialism, the struggle against apartheid. But at the same time, it is a perfectly imperfect place as well, because you also discover insider-outsider status within that particular community. Give us a sense of, or those who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, of how double-edged life in Zambia was. On the one hand, you have this pan-Africanist ideal on the part of the president, but sometimes that ideal doesn't necessarily trickle down to the women who are gossiping about your mom.
I mean, I want to talk a little bit about the whole contemporary notion of exile, because I think it's important politically, you know, those comments by, you know, Lindiwe Sisulu, and there's been, I think, a stream of thinking and discussion in South African contemporary life since the exiles returned, since we were called returnees. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to recognize that this book is not any kind of definitive look at exile, because one of the wonderful things is at the moment, Reedy's book is out, and Kwezi looks at another story of exile, a much more difficult and painful and sad story of exile. So one of the things that happened when when people left South Africa, that first generation, those who left in the early to mid 1960s, when I say first generation, I mean in large numbers, because Black South Africans had been leaving for quite some time for different reasons. But one of the things that happened is that as they crossed the border, they carried their class position with them. So the way that the ANC has always functioned as a deeply classist organization was that there were mission-educated Africans who were African middle class, which didn't mean they had money, but they certainly had access to an education and saw themselves in a particular way. So Mandela and Tambo don't simply arise, you know, out of the hills. They are formed and shaped by a particular class position and see themselves as better, which is I'm not criticizing them gratuitously. I'm just describing the facts. And so when the ANC people went into exile, they were given choices. And the ones who were mission educated were told, you will be educated and you will study so that you can come back to a free South Africa and play this important role. And for the most part, the masses, those who were not exempted natives, were sent as and trained as soldiers. And those who trained as soldiers who were from the African middle classes were, I think, people I am particularly proud of. So Chris Hani is a good example. My own father is a good example. All of them, but people made those choices. And so it's to say that my exile was the posh end of exile precisely because of the inbuilt classism of the African National Congress, which is something I think we have to be honest about, even as it gives me beautiful nostalgic memories about my childhood. That's what it affords.
But that's where, and I, you know, I mean, I'm busy trying to finish this piece about how your book intersects in interesting ways, as you know, with the books by Ridi Klabi, but also Phumla Gqola. You had the same class and race complexity with Inzales. It's just that we don't talk about it. And one of the things I love about your book and Phumla's books, and you too as persons, is that you're not trying to run away from your class privilege that you had, whether it be growing up on the campus of Fort Hare, or whether it is growing up with a dad who was busy looking at insects and plants while fighting the war against liberation. But I think that's very important. And as someone who embraces irreducible complexity, speak to me about whether that was something that was difficult for you to articulate as a writer in the present, where there's often this Olympics of suffering that happens amongst young people within the left and within civil society. And here you have Phumla saying, I know I'm one of your faves, but let me have you know that I grew up with professors at Fort Hare, and there's a Sonke, and we learn that, gosh, okay, so dad was just not only this gorilla, he was also an academic.
So it wasn't hard, and I'll tell you why. Because at heart, I am an Africanist. And so when I write, to the extent that I think about an audience, which, as you know, you don't want to write a book thinking about an audience, but I'm also alive in this world, and so I know that hopefully people will buy it. But when I write, I think about, who am I speaking to? Who do I want to have the most intimate conversation with? And that's Africa, not only South Africa. So when you begin to think about yourself as writing an African book, if such a thing can exist, then you think, okay, so I chose memoir for lots of reasons, one of which is was a shortcut because I know the subject well. I didn't have to go out and research. But also because I do believe it's important for Africans not to only have our stories be stories of big men. So in South Africa, that's been, you know, Mandela. And there's great importance in talking and writing about Nelson Mandela from different angles. And I'm really grateful and happy to see, you know, Mandla Langa's new book. You know, it gives us an insight into an aspect of the man. We will forever write about him and should. But I also want us to be able to expand the pool of what stories look like. So in South Africa, we have big men that we like to talk about. And in the rest of the continent, we like to talk about child soldiers. And in between, there is real life. And so I wanted to write a book not as something about me as someone who has achieved something, because I don't think at this age there are any achievements that I can tick off. I wanted to write a story about that says, I want to affirm the notion that Africans can tell our own stories and every little life is worth examining.
Eusebius is on Twitter at Eusebius.
You know, one of the strangest things about giving feedback to a friend who's busy writing is that you want creative feedback, because I know that's what Sasonke wants. And at the same time, you also respond to a work, a manuscript, with humanity. Mm. And one of the hardest things is writing about sexual violation. And I remember thinking to myself the first time I read that part of the manuscript, the first version that you had sent me, Sasonke, and I thought to myself, how do I give Sasonke feedback on this chapter? Because when someone has been violated, how do you look them in the eyes, a friend, and say, rewrite this chapter like a fiction writer would? Because as someone who was raped, I know that the reality is that you do not necessarily have creative or authorial control over the words you use when you articulate that experience. And so giving you that experience as a writer. So I want us to give readers an insight that they don't often get when they read a final product. And there are other moments in the book I'll do the same with. But writing, I think you said, Akin put it beautifully, into the horror of the nightmare. Writing into that, how hard is that and how difficult is it, particularly something you're good at? I don't know if you enjoy it, but you're better than most of us at editing, because when you go over passages that are deeply personal, it's extremely hard to revisit them, let alone to revisit them and go, maybe some structural changes. Maybe the violation should happen on page 93 rather than 93. This is extremely difficult because you are not writing fiction.
Yeah. So I think one of the things I've been saying a lot in this last week, people have asked me a lot about this question, but the broader question about writing about difficult things or painful things, is that, you know, a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Every single story that is a real story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So what you have in this book are many of my stories. Hmm. And every story that made it in, so if it doesn't have a beginning and a middle and an end, it's an anecdote, right? Hmm. You're telling me about something that just happened now in the street, but you're not resolving it. You're not closing a circle. So what I hope that I have presented in this book is a sort of basket of complete circles, right? Hmm. And so because it's a circle and it has an end, it's over for me, which doesn't mean that I don't carry it with me, but that I understand it. I understand the experience. And so while I think it's important to be able to write into the nightmare, that's only possible because you've woken up, because you survived the nightmare, right? Mm-hmm. So in the morning, you're like, oh my God, I had this crazy nightmare, you know, and then you can talk about it because it's over. You're not scared anymore. And so so from a position of craft, I didn't look at anything, even the incident of sexual assault, I didn't look at that as anything but a section that I needed to work on from a position of craft. Because when you're crafting the story, what you then are able to do is you can determine the pace, you can determine the reveal, which is the conversation that you and I had at Eusebius, in which we differed in the end. You have control over how you tell the story. And in some ways, as a survivor of sexual violence, what better reward and gift can you have in life than not only surviving, but being the one who is able to tell the story the way you want to tell the story.
Absolutely. I'm going to, obviously you need to, I mean, if you haven't bought the book already, where have you been in the last week or so? Make sure you go get it at all reputable bookstores, definitely at exclusives. I see it everywhere. I always look out for my friends' books so that I can troll the places that don't stock them. And Always Another Country is available. Even in PE, I bought a copy over the weekend at a very obscure bookstore. So it is certainly very widely available. So do go and get yourself a copy. I'm only giving you little bits of the vignettes in the book. And I'm going to read a bit from page 74, then we'll take a news break. And then we're going to reflect on one of my favorite parts, because every time, and I'm not going to do it today because it would have been too predictable, every time I listen to Richard Marx, I think of Sasonke. So I love it when I travel with Sasonke to Canada. But Canada, again, was interesting, a very interesting time in her life. So I'm on page 74, and I'll just read you a little bit to make you fall in love with her as an author. Fall came and I liked it. The leaves were not just leaves. They were like little pieces of paper someone had scattered in the air and on the ground as they had turned yellow and then red. I began to feel as though I may be okay here. We got into a routine of school and play and homework, and it was still different, but no longer seemed like an odd and misshapen life, the way it had at first. And then one day, in the middle of everything that was becoming mundane and ordinary, on a day just like the ones that had come before it, I was called an African monkey. The culprit was a boy who had not seemed at all sinister before he said it, so he caught me off guard. The scene remains vivid in my mind, mainly because it was brutal, and I was the only one who cared. Perhaps it was because I was the one he had intended to wound. What mattered then, and still matters now, was that nobody came to my defense. They heard him. They all heard him. There were snickers, and there was laughter. I stood there frozen. Then someone said, "Oh, burn!" as though this was just an ordinary slight, an insult from which I could recover if I thought of a comeback quickly enough. I couldn't, of course, and worse, I began to cry. You want to know what happens next? You better stay tuned.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
The reason I was reading from that particular page, Sasonka, is that one of the most important moments for you, well, there were many such moments before, but in Canada in particular, and I want you to tell the story, a truncated version of it, is, of course, the incredible moral compass that your dad is, because the way he handled that particular incident was a moral lesson that you will never forget.
On many levels. So we get to Canada. An immigrant child is always very invested in fitting in. It's very difficult for a black child in Canada to fit in the 1980s because there were so few of us. So we were, people often talk about black people as invisible, and they're hyper visible in settings where we are such an extreme demographic minority. So we were certainly that. And so we move to this new neighborhood. We're in this new school, and very quickly I'm, because that's how whiteness operates, you have to be marked. And so I'm insulted, called an African monkey, and I cry. And you have to remember, I've been raised in Africa, so that notion of being called that would never have occurred. It didn't even occur in my brain that such a thing would be possible. And so here I am. And so I cry and I go home and I tell my mother, and she responds with the requisite empathy. And then, you know, my dad comes home and he responds with absolute, what is the word? He is horrified and outraged that his child would be a coward and cry when people call her that instead of hitting them. And so I'm re-traumatized by my dad, who's like, you know, this is life. This is going to happen to you, and you need to be able to stand up and deal with it. But also, who has the sort of foresight to also take it up with the school. And so we go to school, and I'm so embarrassed. And we go to school, and we talk to the principal, and the principal, in some ways, acknowledges, but in some ways, is trying to let the kids off the hook. And so my father then insists that I need an apology. So he demands the apology, and the way he conducted himself in that, you know, meeting with the principal has just always been a model for me in how you deal with with conflict and how you maintain your dignity and hold a hard line.
But like you say, it was a very layered experience, because what was so interesting is that the remonstration that happened between your dad and the leader of the school, the headmaster, was interesting, because when we think about Canada, those of us who haven't spent any time there, you see it as a sort of the virtuous version of the USA. But you also, of course, sometimes have a very low anthropology of expectations of Canadians, because after all, Canadians are just nice people. And there your dad is, and he had to read the Riot Act about precisely how it is that this will be handled. You will go to the classroom. You will make sure that there's an apology, that there's a follow-up. And I thought to myself, this is an example of where your subtlety as a writer comes in the sense that it was a critique, wasn't it, of potentially, and this may be very harsh to any Canadians listening, of the soft bigotry of liberalism. Because there you have it, a setting that is meant to be incredibly progressive, in a pluralistic society that embraces all of these kind of values that you have meditated on whilst writing the book, and sends then an important part of your place as a thinker within our society, thinking about cosmopolitanism. And there your dad was pushing the boundaries in terms of critiquing.
Absolutely. And what was the entire intention of a certain kind of niceness, and this is why I am forever grateful to this generation of South Africans who have challenged us around respectability politics, because respectability politics is not just what many of our parents do and what we have learned to do to get along within whiteness. It's also a core and fundamental aspect of liberal, of being a liberal, right? Mm. So the entire intention of the principle was to diffuse conflict, was to make the problem go away. It was not to address the issue morally, confront the injustice so everyone could see it, so that we could then move forward. And what my father forced was the confrontation of the injustice so that it could be dealt with, so that you can then move on.
Another interesting thing that starts happening while you are in Canada, and I want you to reflect a little bit on this, is your relationship with mom, especially the failed attempt to go on an adventure until you realize actually this thing of putting up tents and going everywhere, it's just not going to be for us, is that dad and mom, I think, appears very differently in this memoir. We start off right at the beginning with a description of dad. And then he meets this wonderful Swazi woman, right? But she comes in paragraphs later. So he's there first. Now, the book is in mom's memory. We know that at the beginning, because mom's not around. But in Canada, things change a bit, because suddenly dad is not quite as the continuous presence that he was way back when you were in Zambia. How would you characterize your relationship with your mom and your dad? Because your dad is incredibly important to you, and your mom is a more subtle presence in the book. But in Canada, your dad, like you said, you know, when he returns home, he almost has to get used to a new routine. Mm. So circumstance almost forces mom, both literally but also in literary terms, to be more present once we get to Canada. Until that point, it's very clear that you and your dad are BFFs.
Totally. I mean, so obviously my father is the reason we were in exile. So in some ways, the book begins with him by way of preamble. He is my preamble. He is our exile preamble. But he has always been our shining star, like the admiration. He's been the twinkling one in the sky. And so my sisters and I always admired, there's something about fathers and daughters, people always say this, and there is something about that dynamic, I think. But also, what part of my own journey in life, and what I hope I show in this book, was that because my mother is a woman, her labor is unseen, invisible, and not respected, even by her own children who are girls. So she enables us, but we don't see her for a very long time. We love her, but there's a taken for granted. You can take your mother for granted. And in a two-parent family, you can admire your father because your mom gets the work done. And so in the end, my admiration for my mother more than parallels my admiration for my parents. This is a love letter to my parents, but it more than parallels my admiration for my dad. But I had to grow into understanding my mother as a full human being in a way that never happens with men, because society tells us de facto a man is a full human being.
And because patriarchy.
Exactly.
I mean, even the women who are allies of the patriarchs at Burley Court don't help. Because mom's productivity, mom's professionalism doesn't just become a source of gossip, it is in their minds a source of shame. This marriage can't possibly last.
With a woman who has only daughters, he will leave you, number one. Secondly, she's too busy. She's busy earning the money. And this guy has this, you know, life where he's a freedom fighter, he's gone sometimes, he's around, he's wandering around with the kids, he's taking too much care of them, going into, you know, collect insects. So my parents had a very unconventional, the early years of our lives were very unconventional, with mom being this more stable. And she was always stable. And I think that's a wonderful role models to have, but I didn't realize it until I got old enough to fully see it. Yeah.
Okay. I want to give Sasanka another chance. For her last reading, she got 7 out of 10.
After you had hyped me. Yo.
So now she wants to do a little bit better. We're going to go to, I mean, don't get it wrong. You know, obviously, Sasanka and I are very close friends. So this is both a professional interview, but also deeply, deeply proud of her as my friend. There's actually lots of laughter in the book. It's not just this subtle, difficult exploration of place and home and exile and politics. You will laugh every other page, particularly when we get to America and some of the characters that you encounter. Can you go to page 140, Sasanka? Fresh, that is her name, Sasanka Musuman.
Yes, I'm on 140. Where do you want me to start?
One should always start with trouble. Right at the bottom of page 40 or 140.
Trouble, especially when you're not looking for it, is usually nondescript. He looks too old to be a student, although not by much. He is short and slight and dressed immaculately in a white linen jacket and white linen pants, as though he had just strolled off the set of Miami Vice. He is even the same color as the black guy on the show, whom everyone loves because he looks like he is a 0.5, which was our slang way of saying half-caste in Nairobi, which I will soon learn is not a term that anyone in America uses. They say biracial. Anyway, so Trouble is short and light and dressed like a Cubano, and when he speaks, he has a voice like Fred Sanford. I am tall, and a long time ago, I decided not to like 0.5 guys because it's so predictable. I decided to only fall in love with very dark-skinned guys because of black is beautiful and predictability. Plus, I have never liked guys who are shorter than me, even though that is also very predictable. But I'm 18, and I can't be expected to think everything through thoroughly. All this to say that nothing about this situation seems conducive to a love match. His opening line comes as no surprise, and as soon as I hear it, I am irritated and I want to move on so I can get back to my banking drive-thru. Hey, girl, heaven must be looking for you, because I am gobsmacked by the actual real-life use of a line my friends and I have laughed at least 2 years. I wonder whether this is a trick, whether he isn't some sort of joke my Nairobi friends are playing on me, sending me the exact opposite of my type to come and drop tired lines on me on my first day in America. I respond with a terse hello, the kind that is supposed to say, I'm not really interested and I'm just saying hello because I don't want to be rude. He doesn't notice my frostiness. Where are you from, Angel? You go to school here? My well-raised African girl politeness problem rears its timid head again, and so instead of rolling my eyes and walking away, I respond, yes, I'm a student here, but I'm in a bit of a hurry, so I can't really speak with you right now. I'm starting to move even as I say this, but he falls in step with me. Listen to you. You sound like some kind of uppity girl. He does a poor imitation of my accent. I can't speak. He laughs at his own joke, and then he continues, you from Connecticut or something? Sorry, I say. I'm really in a hurry. By this time, we are standing in front of a lift that will take me to the third floor, which is where my room is, 309 Doty. I try to move past him to press the button for the lift, but he moves faster than me, and he blocks my way. Come on, girl. You haven't told me your name. This is said in a half whisper that may have worked in a Hollywood film set, or even on someone who is not tired and irritable as I am. It's not going to work on someone unattracted to the sayer of those words.
Wow. 10 out of 10. The accents were on point, especially towards the end as she got into a groove. Give a round of applause there for reading. Reading of it. Let's take a young break. I know we've got 14 minutes left. Oh, I suppose you better also have a piece of her. If you have read the book, what has been your favorite so far? Millions of tweets. I'll read some of those. If you want to say, how's it? You want to ask her a question? We've got 40 minutes left with Sasanka Musuman, the author of Always Another Country. Call us on 011-883-0702 in Johannesburg and in Cape Town on 021-446-0567.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Okay, lots and lots and lots and lots of tweets. I can only read some of these. Reedy, and we were gossiping nicely about you, Sasonke. Isn't she just so generous?
Amazing, 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 amazing. And generosity costs time, and it takes energy. And Reedy doesn't have to be generous. And so I am so grateful for the generosity, really.
Yeah, she says, Sasonke has she says many things, but one of the many things that I agree with, really, well, I agree with everything you say about the book, which she says, Sasonke has a masterful way of describing fear and trepidation. My heart was pounding when she introduced trouble. He frightened me. Absolutely. We can feel the pace quickening. But it's also like, this is the other thing that's really fun, right? That we also must be positive about, because there's also the absolute joy of being in different places. And America is a world in one.
Wow. Wow. What a place. And I mean, despite... So, yeah, America is a world in one. And it is a very important place to me politically and personally because of the time of my life that I lived there. But also because it's fun.
Hmm. So, I know one of the other people that had read an early version of the book and was talking to you about something that they thought you should think about, which you and I have spoken about in different terms, Sasonke. And that, of course, is the fact that Sasonke Msimang is a black feminist married to a white man living in Australia.
Whose last name is White.
Whose last name is White. For those who are reductionists, can you square the circle? Alternatively, they can read Simon, of course, and go to page 217. Love this picture, by the way. We're not going to read from there. I just want you to describe how important that is. Because I remember, I mean, you know, people tend to hear what they want to hear. They tend to read what they want to read. If they want to only read your criticism of the DA, they will say, why are you obsessed about the DA? And then lo and behold, if you do a tally, you will find that actually 60% of her political stuff might actually be about the ANC. So what the reader brings to the process, you've got no control over.
Yes.
Right? And that's very hard to get used to. So sometimes when Sasonke writes what someone deems to be sufficiently woke, they will love you to bits. And then another occasion, they will want to take that away and say, oh, well, she's just trying to revive the Rainbow Nation Kumbayaism, which besides being inaccurate, you once told me, and I'm not sure, I don't think you'll mind me saying this, is that I never claimed to be woke.
Yeah.
I even have a white husband.
Exactly. And I always have from the first. So one of the things that has been interesting to me about writing publicly is from the minute I wrote my first article, I was already married to the white guy. Like, I never, it just didn't happen afterwards. So there's no retrospectivity about my views. My views, I'm a difficult person to be married to for anyone. I would be a difficult person to be married to for any man, because I have a critique of patriarchy that doesn't give sometimes. But I also am a person who will not pretend that issues aren't there if they're, you know, if they're there. So my talking about being in an interracial relationship, I felt was very important because there's two strands of thinking in South Africa. Mm. Either you are quote unquote radical and think that it is impossible for relationships to exist between white and black in any equal sense because of the structural nature of our economy and our life. And I have a lot of time and energy for that position. Or you are a Rainbow Nation Kumbaya and you believe that interracial relationships are perfect because, after all, we're only human and I don't see color. Mm. And of course, that doesn't work for me either. Mm. So I wanted to explore the complexity of what it means to live in a world where you accept that there are structural power imbalances between people and that you can also understand. And so I understand and have sympathy for that argument, but that I also can't look at somebody who loves me and whom I love and pretend that that's not true, walk away from the face of that. So, yeah.
Why do you write?
I did not have the chapter in the book called Why I Write until after the book was finished. It was a late addition that was suggested to me by someone. And in the spirit of taking on feedback, I did that. And I didn't want to do it initially because I thought, this makes me seem as if I feel like I'm some kind of public intellectual. And then I feel like I'm having to own that space more and more. Maybe not a public intellectual, but someone who contributes to the conversation. So I do write for that reason. But I also write because I want to have space and distance from my children who are always on my ankles. And I think putting words down on a page and having the quiet time and having that respected by my family is a very important thing for my kids to see.
Coletta says, can she please read the entire book? And I'm telling you, she's getting better and better with every reading assignment I give her. She now does voices. If she keeps a word, she also, I noticed there, one or two sentences, she was freestyling.
Because
as long as it made sense.
I was editing it as I was reading it because I was like, how did we miss this?
So we're going to get her to read one of the more beautifully, poetically structured bits, which is in the chapter from why it is that she writes her meditation. And we'll just let her read for the last 3 minutes. And you will go and buy the book and buy one for a friend because books are expensive. Go to page 295, Sisonke. At first, I wrote to make Mummy and Baba proud, so I also wrote, I guess, out of a certain sentimental yes, we can-ness. I write now for slightly different reasons, and then I want you to read from there to the end of the next page.
Okay, it's a nice long read. At first, I wrote to make Mummy and Baba proud, so I also wrote, I suppose, out of a certain sentimental yes, we can-ness. I write now for slightly different reasons. I write because I am an African woman who is literate, and there is no diminishing what this means in a context in which so many others cannot. I write to escape my children and to find my peace with them. I write sometimes just to hear them say, are you still writing a book? How many pages is it, Mama? I write because Africans and women and humans who have been considered less than others, have always had stories and imaginations to take us out of the impossibility of the situations in which we have found ourselves stranded. I write because Simbiwe Dana sings and because Brenda Fassie is dead. In the face of the certainty of death, what else can I do? Where else can I go but the page when I am overcome by the knowledge that yesterday's songs were sung by women who died because they worked too much and lived in a world that was too hard and yet their melodies were so soft? What else can I do but write when I know life is not just breath, it is also voice? I write because I cannot paint and I cannot sing. Words are my brush and my warbled song. I have written in the margins of every book I have ever loved, so I write because I read. I write because I'm black, that peculiar word that is more than the brown of my skin. Black is a solid mass of many shades that stand together facing the future. It is a whole. Black is an equation defying even Einstein's brilliance, even as it is nothing, not a thing at all. I write for myself because women seldom have spaces for themselves, and writing is a space. It takes up space. It creates space. It gives me space. I write because writing is solitary, and women are seldom alone with just their thoughts. Their responsibilities always intrude. There is this to be done and that to be paid for, and those moments when it's just you and your words are rare and all the more beautiful. I write because South Africa was liberated and she is not yet free. I write because I have been let down, and sometimes I write because I do not know the answer and I am hoping someone might search with me. I write because when I was in high school, Baba marked up my essays with a red pen. I write because Mommy taught me how to spell. Just like she taught me the only true thing that counts, which is that you are always only one breath away from death. I write because, as Nikki Giovanni said about love, there is nothing for me but to write.
Oh, that's so stunning. Final question. It's too long for now. We'll do it when you come back from Australia, but it's just a thought. So, where is exile and where is home? Or what are they?
Home is, as cliche as it sounds, it is in the love that you have for the people who make you feel most adored. And exile is where you feel that you have been banished. And so exile is outside the circle of love.
Thank you, darling.
Thank you.